for Friday, July 7, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Abogado. Leaders from the world's most powerful nations prepare to meet in St. Petersburg for the G8. As international football fans prepare for this Sunday's final game, we'll hear about racist attacks in Germany. And as Felipe Calderón is declared the winner in Mexico's presidential elections, we'll hear what that could mean in Washington. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A Spanish judge has issued an international order for the capture of former Guatemalan dictator Efraín Ríos Montt, along with seven others accused of acts of genocide during the country's civil war. Jill Replico reports from Guatemala City.
Today's arrest orders come nearly a week after Spanish judge Santiago Pedras cut short a trip to Guatemala. Pedras was in the country to investigate accusations of genocide and other war crimes committed by Guatemalan officials during the late 1970s and 1980s. The case was brought before the Spanish justice system by Guatemalan Nobel Prize laureate Rigoberto Menchú. Menchú's father was killed during a government siege on the Spanish embassy in Guatemala City in 1980. During Pedras' trip to Guatemala, he was scheduled to hear testimonies from witnesses and the accused. However, lawyers for the defense blocked the hearings by presenting a series of legal obstacles. European media outlets report that Pedras issued the arrest order to ensure that the accused could not continue to block the investigation. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Guatemala City.
In China, an explosion this morning at a home in the coal-rich province of Shanxi killed 47 people and wounded over two dozen. China's official news agency, Xinhua, reports that a fire in a home storing explosives triggered the blast. The house exploded as neighbors were trying to extinguish the blaze. Shanxi province accounts for a huge portion of China's coal production, and accidents resulting from unsafe conditions at the mines or from the illegal storage of explosives are not uncommon. A gas explosion at a mine near the site of today's disaster killed 36 people on July 2nd of last year. Shanxi province has seen two other major accidents resulting from privately stored explosives in the past 4 months. The Israeli military operation dubbed Summer Rain continues to pound Gaza with parallel attacks on locations in the West Bank. Manar Jabrin has the latest.
Israeli soldiers, tanks, and armored vehicles continue to advance within the northern Gaza Strip. Airstrikes there have killed at least three people today. A fourth resident died of wounds sustained during yesterday's assault on the town of Beit Lahia in the northern Gaza Strip. The three Palestinians were killed in the siege of a Beit Lahia neighborhood when Israeli soldiers fired live rounds at dozens of houses. Two more people were killed when an Israeli warplane fired a missile on a residential area in a different neighborhood of the same town. The missile damage also wounded 80 residents, including 27 children. In the West Bank city of Nablus, troops shot and killed Tamer Kandil, one of the fighters of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed wing of Fatah movement. At least four residents were injured in the attack. The soldiers broke into several homes, turning one into a military post from which to launch attacks on the Palestinian resistance fighters in the area. Ramadan Al-Adasi, a leader of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade.
Israeli troops opened fire from their positions at fighters from Al-Aqsa Brigades who were in the area. Tamer Kandil was injured, but he was not killed. However, the soldiers broke into the house where he was, captured him, and killed him in cold blood. They also prevented medical crew from reaching him.
Soldiers killed two people and injured several others during a failed assassination attempt last night in the West Bank refugee camp of Jenin. An Israeli undercover unit invaded the camp and broke into a home, firing live ammunition. Israeli forces have killed at least 30 people in the Palestinian territories in the last 24 hours. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
The law school at St. Mary's University in San Antonio will receive $1 million from the federal government to study ways of restricting public data that would otherwise be available through Freedom of Information Act requests. St. Mary's law professor and former Army Special Forces legal advisor Jeffrey Atticott told USA Today that the $1 million grant comes from this year's Defense Department budget and is administered by the Air Force Research Laboratory. The Freedom of Information Act turned 40 earlier this week. The budget crisis that forced a partial government shutdown in New Jersey is almost over. The state's governor and legislators reached an agreement on Thursday to raise sales taxes by 1%, provided that half of the revenue generated by the increase will go towards lowering property taxes. Bills must pass the New Jersey Assembly and Senate before the new measures can take effect. The UK is commemorating the one-year anniversary of the London subway and bus bombings. Tom Allen reports.
A year has passed since the bombings that shook London, killing 52 people and wounding hundreds of others. A commemoration service took place in Regent's Park today, and nationwide a two-minute silence was observed. A service in honour of the dead also took place in Beeston in Leeds, the home of two of the young Muslim men responsible for the bombings.
It's partly as a sort of commemoration of what happened, but mostly really as a sign of the community's determination to continue growing together and looking forward.
Says the Reverend John Bishop, a spokesman for the local community group Faith Together in Leeds 11. Bishop says that Beeston remains a very cohesive and integrated community.
It's a very mixed area. There's people from different Muslim communities, and there's also people from other communities all around the world. A lot of people from Africa, but a lot of white people as well. People only come to Beeston, actually, if they're happy like that. If they don't want to live in a mixed community, they go somewhere else.
A video linking Al-Qaeda to the bombings was broadcast yesterday on Al Jazeera. The video features bomber Shahzad Tanweer blaming British foreign policy in Muslim countries for the attacks he was to carry out. Although the timing of the video's release was probably meant to cause panic and distress, the overall atmosphere in Leeds and in London today has been one of unity and perseverance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tom Allen, reporting from Edinburgh.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Mexico's Federal Election Institute announced right-wing candidate Felipe Calderón as the winner of the country's presidential elections. The final vote count put Calderón ahead by a mere 200,000 votes. That's about half a percentage point ahead of opponent Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Obrador is disputing the results, calling on the Electoral Tribunal to review the vote tallies. Meanwhile, his supporters are organizing a mass rally in Mexico City's center tomorrow, criticizing what they say is electoral fraud. The United States has not yet commented on the elections, but Mexico's new president will have a direct impact on policies affecting the two neighboring countries. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Washington.
The United States has paid little attention to the national elections of their southern neighbors. Yesterday, U.S. President Bush met with Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin. At a news briefing following their meeting, where they tell the press what they spoke about, they mentioned Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and trade issues. They didn't mention Mexico. In a subsequent question and answer period for the press, not one reporter asked about Mexico's presidential elections. And in an hour-long news conference with the president in Chicago today, Mexico was again left out. Armando Guzman is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief at TV Azteca.
People come to me and say, well, what do they say about us in Washington, huh? And I say, well, nothing.
Mexico is embattled in a hotly contested presidential election, only the third since complete democratic elections were instituted 12 years ago. After 4 days of vote counting, and despite claims of fraud by some Mexicans, the Federal Elections Institute, or IFE, declared the right-wing candidate Calderón the winner. They said he received nearly 36% of the vote, just 200,000 more votes than the center-left candidate López Obrador. López Obrador has not ceded to the loss. And the United States has not yet commented on the elections. But the outcome will not only impact the people of Mexico, but also those in the United States. The two countries share 2,000 miles of border. Millions of Mexicans migrate into the United States. The U.S. is the largest customer of Mexican goods, and Mexico is one of the largest exporters of oil to the United States. Arturo Valenzuela is professor of government and director of the Center of Latin American Studies at Georgetown University. During the Clinton administration, he was in charge of U.S.-Mexico relations in the National Security Council. He says the United States forgets about its neighbors in the global economy.
There is nothing clearer than the immigration debate to make that point. Who in the immigration debate has stood up and said, wait a minute, Mexico is going through one of the complex transitions that's taking place in the world today. It is in our fundamental interest that Mexico be a stable, prosperous country in the future. How can we address that? And where does the immigration issue come in to play on that?
Most Mexicans come to the United States in search of jobs. More than half of Mexico's population lives in poverty. So job creation was a dominant topic throughout the campaign. Calderon was a candidate of continuity, to continue along the same path of President Vicente Fox in supporting free trade as a mechanism of growth and gaining support from the United States. He urges the United States to help create a strong economy in Mexico to help limit migration to the north. Center-left candidate López Obrador wanted to distance himself a bit from the United States and renegotiate NAFTA. To help small farmers unable to compete with large U.S. farms, he wanted to lift the tariffs of two Mexican staples, corn and beans. The tariffs are set to expire in 2008. Lauren Freeman is a Mexico researcher at the Washington Office on Latin America.
With the trade agreement, there are winners and there are losers. And so Calderon probably sees things more from the point of view of the people in the sectors that benefited from the trade agreement, because there were some. And then López Obrador identifies more strongly with the people that saw no benefit, that actually were negatively affected by it.
On issues such as immigration, trade, and drug control, experts who work closely with both countries say a partnership between the two, and possibly even a regional partnership including Canada, would have to work to build up Mexico in the global economy. James Jones is a former ambassador to Mexico from 1993 to 1997.
And I think Canada and the United States have a big obligation to have a serious development fund to help Mexico achieve some of the steps toward a modern economy and a modern society.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
G8 country leaders and the European Union will meet next week in St. Petersburg as Russia assumes charge of the summit's presidency this year. Participants have agreed on both a to-talk-about list as well as a must-not-mention list. Jan Meshay has the preview of the summit agenda in Washington, D.C.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said today the G8 agenda has gained approval from participants. Energy security tops the list of topics. As the crude oil price sits on a record $75 per barrel, Lavrov says the meeting will seek a coordinated strategy to address soaring fuel demand and lagging supply. Both the Iran nuclear crisis and North Korea's recent missile launch will also be key issues for discussions and negotiations. Lee Feinstein, a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, says the G8 summit will only second the UN Security Council's upcoming resolution on North Korea. On the issue of Iran, he says, the U.S. will approach it with patience.
Their most important objective is avoiding transatlantic division. And so there is great danger in setting deadlines for definitive responses, and there will be monumental efforts made to avoid crises.
Russia has put in efforts to veer conversations away from its democratic credentials. Although the U.S. government has complained about Russian President Vladimir Putin's heavy-handed governing style, Stephen Sestanovich, a Russian expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, says President Bush will not bring those tough talks into the meeting.
A very senior administration official said to me recently, we're not going to rip into him just before we sit down to try to do business. And I think that's clearly going to be the watchword here. There's not going to be a lot of ripping into him. We've seen this many times before.
By him, Sestanovich means Mr. Putin. Last year's G8 summit focused on the development of African countries. At the urge of British Prime Minister Tony Blair, G8 leaders pledged a large amount of financial aid and debt cancellation to African nations. Diana Duarte, Program Associate of African Action, says many of the promises from last summer have fallen short.
After the summer meetings in 2005, there was almost immediate attempts by the World Bank and the IMF to back down on some of these commitments. For example, Mauritania was briefly dropped from the deal over concerns on governing practices. And there was attempts to add even more economic conditions and more hurdles for the countries to leap over in order to get cancellation.
The G8 summit will run from July the 15th to 17th. Permanent members of the group include Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, and the United States. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Four key international health policy organizations have welcomed a focus on infectious diseases ahead of the G8 summit. Although several promises made during last year's conference of leaders from the world's most powerful nations have gone unfulfilled, groups like the World Health Organization are hopeful the G8 will carry out a plan to combat infectious diseases like AIDS in the world's poorest countries. Here in the United States, people of color, young people in their teens and early 20s, and women are at an increasing risk of infection. FSRN's Maeve Conran reports from Colorado, where the Latino community is one group facing an uphill battle with HIV/AIDS.
According to the Latino Commission on AIDS, incidents of AIDS and HIV are soaring in America's Latino community due to delays in testing and treatment. In 2004, HIV infections amongst Latinos increased by 30%. While Colorado has not experienced this dramatic increase, health officials warn that the state could soon follow suit. Kate Storm is HIV Outreach Coordinator for Boulder County Public Health.
Our numbers are definitely increasing in Colorado at a rate that is not succinct with our population growth. So we need to make sure that we start responding to this epidemic in the Latino community.
One way health officials are responding is through Latino-specific outreach for testing and HIV education. Rodolfo Martinez-Puentes is an HIV prevention coordinator with the Boulder County AIDS Project.
I'm going to the community finder and looking for groups, Latinos, and I could do an education presentation.
One group in the Latino community Puentes tries to reach is the migrant farm workers. Wesley Tashir Rodriguez is the director for health policy for the Latino Commission on AIDS. He says that while migrant farm workers are often ignored when it comes to HIV outreach, they are at particular risk for infection.
We see a lot of examples of migrant males going to work on a farm and leaving their family. They would not call themselves homosexual, but yet they have sex with men because that's who they're around. And we see that with the migrant population. And they come back to a wife that thinks that their husband's been faithful, but it turns out that that person has been having unprotected sex with either a man or a woman.
Rodolfo Puentes says these new migrants lack education, let alone education on sexual health. Couple this with the reluctance to discuss sex and the barriers to HIV outreach multiply.
The Latino community is coming to the United States for the U.S. dream, and they're working hard for making money, and they don't care about what happens with the STDs, HIV, because they have sex, but they don't talk about it.
Puentes and Rodriguez agree that these workers are geographically isolated from the larger community, sharing cramped housing conditions on the farms, and it is this sense of isolation that can lead to risky behaviour. One group which is trying to reach out to these isolated workers is the Salud Family Health Clinic in Commerce City.
Everybody got a hold?
Salud's mobile health unit brings a team of health professionals to the farms where the farm workers work and often live. Going to where these migrants work and live is vital, says Salud's migrant health director, Clara Cabanis.
We're trying to reach the population that usually don't come to the clinic, young men that feel healthy, and we do the screenings for them, and we're finding out that they're not healthy, they have diabetes, hypertension, and all the diseases that are silent for them.
All of us, you know, but when?
Max Rodriguez, who drives the Salud mobile unit, hands out hygiene kits to the farm workers after their physical exams.
Condoms.
Healthcare workers agree that the distribution of free condoms is a definite step in the fight against the spread of HIV and AIDS, but just giving them out does not guarantee their use. And as Kate Storm of Boulder County Health explains, there are usually many other factors.
HIV is not a standalone thing. It often comes with different issues, whether it be injection drug use or other substance use issues, mental health issues, domestic violence and sexual assault, or other unsafe relationships.
The Latino Commission on AIDS is working to reverse the trend of AIDS infections in their community. They are fighting to break down barriers such as cultural and language differences and reluctance amongst many Latinos to acknowledge homosexuality in an effort to educate about HIV prevention. And whilst media attention often focuses on the AIDS epidemic in the developing world, they warn that we must not forget about the epidemic here in the US. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Colorado.
From Clinton's never-realized universal plan to Bush's health savings accounts, federal efforts have yet to stabilize the cost of health care in the U.S. Some states are sick of waiting for a cure as their budgets absorb the emergency room costs of the nearly 46 million uninsured people across the nation. As Joshua Smith reports, states like Massachusetts and others are making reforms a local practice.
As of now, Hawaii is the only state that requires all of its citizens to have health insurance. Massachusetts is trying to become the second. When Governor Mitt Romney signed the new Mass Health Care Plan last April, the media touted the move as precedent-setting. Many speculated that it might lead the way for state-level health care reform. Now in July, some of the bill's more loose outlines are beginning to take shape. Most recently, officials have addressed employer regulations for employee health insurance. As the bill becomes more defined, many are concerned that the bill is not living up to its initial hype. Michael Widmer is president of the Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation. He says that the new regulations fairly reflect the original spirit of the legislation.
Well, the advocates have all along wanted to put an obligation on employers to provide, in their view, a minimum level of coverage. The employer community fought that. We said, yes, having a fair distribution of the employer costs is reasonable, but keep in mind, employers are providing very generous health care coverage across the state. We're leading the nation or close to it in terms of employer-based coverage, which is why we can even talk about reaching universal coverage in Massachusetts.
Benjamin Day is the executive director for MassCare, the Massachusetts campaign for single-payer health care. He says the new bill lets employers off the hook while forcing people to buy insurance privately.
I mean, imagine if you were earning, $20,000 to $25,000 a year. You don't have health insurance through your workplace. Now you're forced by law to buy a health insurance plan. The cheapest health insurance plans are about $4,000 a year. That's over 20% of your income. That's a huge cost, you know? Not everyone is going to be able to afford that. So it's a new and very somewhat disturbing way of approaching the healthcare problem.
Day says that he agrees with Widmer. The bill was never intended to create employer mandates, but neither, he says, was it designed to fix healthcare on a large scale.
The reason that this bill was passed in the first place was because Massachusetts was going to lose its federal funds for matching funds for Medicaid. They had to pass some bill which is sort of aimed towards reducing the number of uninsured, or they lose all this federal funding.
Alan Sager is a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. He says the new plan may have been created with good intentions, but it doesn't address the real problem.
The biggest area is clinical waste, where people get unnecessary tests, unnecessary surgery, unnecessary referrals to specialists, unnecessary prescriptions. There are several reasons. Some stem from forces like drug company marketing and advertising. We'd save $50 billion or more this year if we paid Canadian prices for prescription drugs. Also, doctors and hospitals are paid by volume. More care, more patients, more money. We have to pay doctors by methods that allow us to trust them to spend the money carefully. That means giving doctors budgets and holding them accountable for serving all patients fairly with the huge money available. Doctors' decisions control 90 cents on the healthcare dollar.
Sager concludes saying that reforms are urgent, adding that if the current system is allowed to continue, the next moderate to large recession could be enough to crash the entire system. Whether the new Massachusetts health care bill will prove successful is yet to be seen. It will not be ready in its entirety for almost a year. For Free Speech Radio News in Boston, I'm Joshua Smith.
Millions of international football fans have descended on Germany the past month to support their teams in the lead-up to the final game for the World Cup between Italy and France this Sunday. But before the tournament began, there were already a couple of serious racist attacks, including an Ethiopian man who was beaten into a coma outside Berlin. This act prompted the Africa Council of Germany to issue a warning to non-white foreigners about so-called no-go areas where they might encounter attacks by right-wing extremists. Cinema Napard has more from Berlin.
Last year, the Berlin-based Counseling and Education Center, ReachOut, received 68 calls from victims of racist attacks. But many people who are attacked don't know where to go for help and don't go to the police. Sanchita Basu from ReachOut describes an incident that occurred in the last 2 weeks in the middle of the day in central Berlin.
There were 9 women and a man. They are from Sudan and Egypt and Ethiopia. When they were coming by metro, by subway, and they were being verbally attacked, like some hooligans and right extremists sang songs about how they will be deported to Auschwitz and they will be gassed there. But first they will rape them and they will gas them in Auschwitz. And it was metro was full, but no one helped them.
In other incidents, people have been punched, kicked, had beer bottles thrown at them, and been told that Germany is for Germans. But down at the Fanmile in Berlin, it seems that cultural differences have been set aside in the name of football.
Since it started, it's just one party. There are no boundaries, no racism at all. And yesterday we were also here at the Brandenburger Gate to support the German teams, and we're just integrated into the German fans, and they just accepted us as a part of their supporters.
In general, I never experience any racism. You know, I feel well accepted here.
There's some racism, but with the local people, with Germans, with another German, but when they're not from the same race, when they're black, there's some racism.
Simplice Freeman came to Germany from Cameroon 6 years ago, and having experienced racism firsthand, he decided to launch the Racism Helpline over the World Cup period. Although underfunded, the helpline has assisted people in 6 different languages. But Freeman also has another aim.
With this information, we wanted to aim to make a comparison between what the state officials has and what we have, just to tell them that it's really bad talking about racism here, because one thing is sure, they never admit here in Germany that there is a racism. They start talking about racism only in May or in April this year.
Before the World Cup began, there was a heated discussion about so-called no-go areas for non-white people in Germany. Freeman from the Racism Helpline.
We foreigners, we blacks especially, we cannot go in some areas in Berlin, Brandenburg, and even in whole Germany. It's a fact. I remember the first week, it was just like a taboo to talk about no-go areas. But after a week, they all agreed there are no-go areas. Cottbus is a national befreite zone, that means a free land for fascists. Rathenow is a free land for fascists. They say it, and every single German knows it.
Taye Tefera is a member of the Africa Council of Berlin. He's on the board of the Migration Council of Berlin and also runs the Oromo Centre. Tefera says the no-go areas have been exaggerated and are playing into right-wing hands.
I cannot say it is a reality. If we say it is a reality, then we will leave the area what the neo-Nazis are looking for.
Sanchita Basu from ReachOut also disagrees with the term no-go areas.
I think there's certain no-go areas in our head we just have in our imagination. But the reality is it's happening everywhere.
Tefera from the Africa Council and Oromo Centre says the problem of racism must be addressed on both the individual and political levels.
We have to do deep down to the grassroots. We have to start from below. Then at the same time, the state should have a vision. As far as I know, they don't have vision, they don't have concept, they don't have clear agenda for that. I have talked to the Ministry of Interior on both sides, Berlin and Potsdam, and they are worried about that. We have to have a clear concept for the very small minority neo-Nazis in this state.
As the World Cup finishes up this week, anti-racist initiatives throughout Germany will continue their work. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, found online at fsrn.org. For Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Leanne Caldwell, Shannon Young, Monica Lopez, and Simba Russo, I'm Aura Bogado.